And she had several grandchildren. Two of them got $5 million apiece, and two of them got zero. She was more beneficent to her dog than she was to her grandchildren. I went on the computer this afternoon and looked at websites about leaving money, bequeathing money to your animals. And believe it or not, there are many websites where you can do that. You can make out your will to your dog, to your parrot. In fact, one said, how to add your parrot to your will. Another one was called Horse Haven of Tennessee. And there are all kinds of websites where you could, before you died, make sure that your pet, python, parrot, you know, whatever, was taken care of the rest of its lifetime. Maybe only in America do we do that. We have pet cemeteries. Of course, we take our dogs to the cats to the vet and all kinds of animals. We think a great deal of our animals, as I do of my little Minpin. But I'm not about to leave money to my dog rather than to my children, my grandchildren. It's a phenomenon that seems to be uniquely American. When Americans die, according to websites, they leave behind trillions of dollars. I think it was Cornelius Vanderbilt, who was a multi-millionaire, if not billionaire, whose goal in life was to die broke, to give away all of his money, all of his millions, to various charities, et cetera, so that he died the way he was born, with nothing. In the book of Luke, chapter 15, Jesus gives direction, or chapter 16, rather, gives direction to each of us as his children with reference to our money and what to do with it. The chapter begins, he also said, or he said also, depending on translation, to his disciples. There was a certain rich man who had a steward, and an accusation was brought to him that this man was wasting his goods. One translation, instead of wasting, says he was squandering his goods. So he called him and said to him, what is this I hear about you? Give an account of your stewardship, for you can no longer be steward. Then the steward said within himself, what shall I do? For my master is taking the stewardship away from me. I cannot dig. I'm ashamed to beg. I've resolved what to do, that when I'm put out of the stewardship, they may receive me into their houses. So he called every one of his master's debtors to him and said to the first, how much do you owe my master? And he said, 100 measures of oil. So he said to him, take your bill, sit down quickly, and write 50. Then he said to another, and how much do you owe? So he said, 100 measures of wheat. And he said to him, take your bill and write 80. So the master commended the unjust steward because he had dealt shrewdly. For the sons of this world are more shrewd in their generation than the sons of light. And I say to you, make friends for yourselves by unrighteous mammon, that when you fail, they may receive you into an everlasting home. He who is faithful in what is least is faithful also in much. And he who is unjust in what is least is unjust also in much. Therefore, if you have not been faithful in the unrighteous mammon, who will commit to you the true riches? And if you have not been faithful in what is another man's, who will give you what is your own? No servant can serve two masters, for either he will hate the one and love the other, or else he will be loyal to the one and despise the other. You cannot serve God and mammon. Now the Pharisees, who were lovers of money, also heard all these things, and they derided him. On the surface, this parable seems to be very puzzling, because unless we think it through and dig into what it says, it on the surface seems to say the Lord condones dishonesty, because clearly the unjust steward was that. He was taking what did not belong to him and squandering it. Now, Jesus does not bother to tell us in this story, whether true or fictional, what the man was doing with the money. But if Didi were to do that in his company, squander the money, he would probably go to trial and go to jail, as some people in this area have done, as they have pilfered from their companies. And so if one walks away without digging into the parable and thinking, what is this? Here's Jesus, a moral man. Here he is, the Son of God, and he tells the story, and we come away thinking, well, I guess what we ought to do is either we can practice the unethical or the immoral. And it satisfies God because Jesus commended the steward. Well, it's interesting to me that here in chapter 16, we have this particular parable sandwiched or bookended, as Tom would say, in between two other parables which are essentially the same thing. Chapter 15 gives us the account of the prodigal son. And if you look at your account in Luke about the prodigal son, you will find that the same word is used about him. He squandered his inheritance, as this man squandered the boss's money. Except, of course, there's a crucial difference. And that is, with the prodigal son, it was his own money. He asked for his inheritance. His father, perhaps reluctantly, gave it to him. And then the young man went off into a far country, wherever that may have been. And there he used it in what the King James calls riotous living. And that, you can only imagine what he did with it. But he was obviously not very wise with what he had, because when it was all gone, he woke up in the pig pen, feeding husks to the pigs, something a Jewish man would never have done. But the steward in this parable squanders what does not belong to him. Both of them squander it, but one does so because he's decided what to do with his own money, and the other man has decided what to do with somebody else's money. And then in chapter 17, we have the story of the rich man and Lazarus. So isn't it interesting? Of course, we have chapter divisions that never were there when these books were written. But it's interesting that Jesus really has three stories, three parables in a row, that all deal with the same thing. I read somewhere that the New Testament has, and Jesus has, more to say about money than any other topic. I've never counted the passages, and I'd have to take somebody at his or her word about that. But I do know, as you know, that reading the New Testament, there are many passages that deal with money. The Apostle Paul in 2 Timothy deals with the rich. The book of James deals with the rich, and so on. So it obviously was an important topic for the Lord. There were really two audiences that Jesus had in mind. One, the Lord points out at the end of the parable, and the other is implied in verse 1 and then stated explicitly in verse 14, and that was the Pharisees. At the end of the parable, your Bible probably says, as mine does, that when they heard the Lord complete the parable, they scoffed at him. And Luke, by inspiration, adds this parenthetical note. They were lovers of money. Now, they didn't say that, but the Lord knew that, and the Holy Spirit inspired Luke to note that for us. So that's why they scoffed at the parable. Of course, they weren't followers of Jesus. But the second audience was the disciples. And Jesus really rebukes both audiences. The Pharisees, because they love money so much, and his disciples, because they didn't use what they had properly. And I tend to think that whatever the Lord intended for them, he also intends for us. Even though we live in a 2,000 years later, we live in a different culture, a different part of the world, and so on. We are beset with the same temptation that beset those people in that day and that will beset people in the future, however long this world lasts. And wherever people are in this world, money is always a challenge. When the steward learned that someone had told on him and that he was going to have to face the music, we say, and face his master, he had a fivefold problem. First of all, it was that of accountability. And Dee Dee knows, and Greg knows, as accountants, their profession, that audits come along. In fact, my grandson James is preparing for an audit for the new company for which he works. And I remember when I was at FC, an audit would come periodically because somebody has to be responsible for the way money is spent. Because we know human beings get tempted, and money can be misused deliberately or accidentally. So there was a time soon in his mind, the master said, come here. So he knew he had to account for the problem that he had. Secondly, the master told him, you're out of work. Now, he wasn't laid off. He was fired. And there was no unemployment insurance, I'm sure, in the first century. So he was going to be out on the street, and very likely he was going to be penniless, without an income, which was his third problem. You're out of a job, you have no income. Fourth, he said, according to one translation, I'm not strong enough to dig. Now, obviously digging represented probably the lowest level of getting an income, making an income. And he said, I'm simply not strong enough to do that. Had he spent too many years sitting at the desk with his figures and not exercising his muscles? Or was he faking it and just saying, I don't want to dig? And the fifth problem that he faced was, he said, I'm ashamed to beg. And when you think about this man who had this probably rather prestigious position with his master and controlling his money, and the master trusted him, you can imagine that once out of a job, he would walk down the street and people would see him and point him out or ridicule him, and he would have to hide his face in shame. So he said, what am I going to do? Aha! The light bulb goes off in his head. I know what I'm going to do. So he begins to call in his master's debtors because he has a plan in mind. And his plan was ingenious, to make the debtors indebted to him. So he calls one man in and he says, how much do you owe? I have to look at the text. 100 100 measures of oil. And the man says, take your bill and quickly. Now, isn't it interesting? He says, do it quickly. You quickly write down 50. So he chopped the bill in half. Whereas before he owed for 100 barrels of oil or measures of oil, now he only owes 50. Whoa! He just got a real storm there. And then he asked, another man comes in, how much do you owe? Well, I owe 100 measures of wheat. He said, take your bill and write 80. Now this fellow didn't get as good a deal as the first man, but nonetheless his debt dropped. I want you to notice, isn't it interesting that when he called the debtors in, he didn't take the bill and strike out the 100 and put 50, did he? Or strike out 100 and put 80? Who did? He told them to do it. And isn't it interesting that he did that? It would appear to me he's saying, okay, when the time comes, if the bills have to be showed to the boss, I can say, I didn't do it. These people did it. They chopped the bill down, not me. So it would appear that he's shrugging off responsibility and compounding his problem of dishonesty. Well, interestingly enough, when the master learned of this, he did something most unusual. He didn't call the local authorities, didn't call the guards, haul him off to prison. He simply praised him. He said, you acted very shrewdly. And that's probably one of the things in the parable that causes most people to be perplexed. Why would the master do this? It's almost as if he's saying, okay, I accept your dishonesty. Of course, what we don't know about the parable is, number one, did it ever happen? Could it happen? Yes. Did the Lord make up a fictitious story? And that would in no way dilute the meaning of the parable. We do not know in every case now whether or not these things were actual events, like the parable of the sower. We know that it could have happened. It was a daily event, probably, in that part of the world, in a certain time of year, when the sower went out to cast his seed. But for this parable, we don't know that it was factual. The parable in chapter 17 about the rich man and Lazarus may have been an actuality, some theorize, because one of the men is actually named. But that may be a matter of argument. But nonetheless, strangely enough, the master actually commends the steward because he said, you were very shrewd. And then Jesus begins his commentary on his parable. And he says in verse 8, for the sons of this world are more shrewd in their generation than the sons of light. That's not the master speaking in the parable. I think that's Jesus speaking. And he's saying, as all of us ought to know, that there are two separate divisions of people in the world. They're the sons of light, and the opposite, obviously, is true, the sons of darkness. But when he talks about the sons of light, he's talking about us. He was talking to his disciples. And he was saying to them, you are not as shrewd as the people of the world. And many of us would say, Lord, why do you want me to be shrewd? But the Lord begins to explain to us the shrewdness that he expects of us. And it's not anything illegitimate. It's not unethical. It is not immoral. It is not sinful to be shrewd, as the Lord points out in this context. And the Lord is saying once again, many of us are not shrewd, but we need to be. And I say unto you, make friends for yourself by unrighteous mammon, that when you fail, they may receive you into an everlasting home. Now, another thing that puzzles most people in this chapter is the use of the phrase unrighteous mammon. Does it imply that the Lord is saying, when you got your money, you got it immorally or unethically? No. But he is talking about, some translations use the phrase, the mammon of unrighteousness. It actually comes from an Aramaic word that signifies wealth, which is personified as an object of worship. And I think any of us and all of us would say, if I worship my money, then I'm sinful. I've done wrong. I've made something inanimate the object of my devotion and worship, when it ought to be God himself who gives the blessings. Not the blessings, but the God who provides them. And that was a problem, obviously, that the Pharisees had. And the Lord was warning his people, don't you do the same thing. Don't worship your money. After 9/11, I can just see in living rooms across the United States, people going to their computers and in shock. Oh, no. The stock market has crashed. I've lost 50% of my savings. I had a friend at Augusta State University when we were there who said, well, I'm going to have to work several more years to make up for the losses in my retirement. Many people put their confidence, their trust in the almighty dollar, or in some cases the United States in gold and silver. And that's their trust. And when the figures go up, they feel good. And when the market crashes, they feel despondent. Well, they've chosen the wrong thing to worship, haven't they? And put their trust in. It is not in our bank accounts. It is in the God who provides all of this and who owns all of it. And we, like the man in the parable, are just a steward. We are caring for and using somebody else's money, and this person trusts us. That's why Jesus goes on to say, "He who is faithful in what is least is faithful also in much. And he who is unjust in what is least is unjust also in much. Therefore, if you have not been faithful in the unrighteous mammon, who will commit to you the true riches? And if you have not been faithful in what is another man's, who will give you what is your own?" Now, there are basic truths there that even if you didn't read them from the scriptures, you would know it to be true. If you work for somebody else, whether you're a cashier or whatever, and you're handling money, you are hired and you continue your job because somebody places trust in you. And when they find an occasion to no longer trust you, then you're no longer employed. And you're either dismissed or you're brought up on charges or something. Because trust is fundamental in a relationship. And beyond the relationship of the boss and the worker, or the master and the steward in this case, our relationship with God has to be built on trust. And God said, if I can't trust you with little, then why would you ever think I'm going to give you much? I believe that when we rear children, early in life, parents need to teach their children to give. Whether it's pennies, a dollar, or whatever. Because if they're not taught early in life to give to the Lord from what God has given them, will they ever learn it? I encourage college students who, I understand from experience, have relatively little money, maybe pitifully little money. But before you use your last dollar to buy the Coke or whatever, think about the Lord's Day. And when it's time to give on the Lord's Day, give something. If you have little, God does not expect much of you, but I think he expects something of you. If you've been prospered in some way, then God expects something in return out of how he has prospered you and with what he has prospered you. If that's not a biblical teaching, then I don't understand this parable or other teachings similar to it. We simply cannot go through our lives, whether as college students or employed people and so on, up until the time we retire and beyond, and not give anything to the Lord. God is not pleased with us if he entrusts little to us and we squander it. It's all gone. Can't give anything on the Lord's Day. Why? Because I spent it this week. Gone out to fast food or, you know, whatever. Or comes to the end of the month and, you know, there's too much month and not enough of the paycheck left. Well, I realize we're in not ordinary times financially anymore. But certainly God deserves and asks and demands something from us every week, if I understand the scriptures. Give as you prospered. Give willingly. Give joyfully. But give is what the Lord expects. And then Jesus goes on in verse 13 to state another principle that is plain, understandable, and elsewhere in the scriptures. No man can serve two masters. For either he will hate the one and love the other, or else he will be loyal to one and despise the other. You cannot serve God and mammon. Can you imagine with this steward, if suddenly one day, another man appears on the scene and he says, now you're my steward. And the steward says, well, wait a minute. I was hired by this man. No, you're mine. Well, he would say, look, I can't serve two masters. I can only serve one. And that's the point that Jesus is making. Many a person in this country, any country in the world, has and any age, has allowed wealth to become his or her master. And when we serve it, and when we worship it, even though we may not recognize it, then we can no longer serve God. And Jesus said, you've got to make a decision. Which one are you going to serve? Well, if you serve mammon, the end result will be you either will spend it all in this life or you'll leave it behind for somebody else to spend. And if we serve God, Jesus says that we're going to use it to, like the steward, make friends. There's an exact parallel there, and that's why Jesus put this in the parable. The steward said, I'm going to make friends so that when I'm out of a job, they'll welcome me into their homes. I can go knock on a door and say, you know, brother, Mr. So-and-so, remember how I had your bill cut in half? Okay, I'm out of work. I don't have a meal. I don't have a place to sleep. And so his anticipation was they would say, well, come right in. You're a friend of mine. You did a great deed for me. I'm going to return the favor. That was his strategy. And Jesus says that should be your strategy and my strategy. Now, it sounds rather crass, doesn't it? To say, okay, I've got this money and I'm going to start to dole it out so that when the bank account says zero, that people will start saying, well, come over to my house. I have a meal. I've got clothing for you, et cetera, et cetera. Well, the Lord didn't say that's going to happen on earth. He said in the everlasting kingdom, people will say to you, Shane, come on in. You helped me in life. I was down and out. I remember what you did for me. I want you to come on in. There'll be outstretched arms, as it were. I don't know that the Lord intended this to be literal. But I do know it is the truth. That when you pass on and when I pass on, if I have been the kind of steward that Jesus expected me to be, that there will be those who welcome me. And the Lord won't be saying to me at the judgment, go away, I never knew you, never approved of you. The Lord will say, come to my right hand. And there will be people, as it were, saying to you and to you and to you, come on in because you helped me in life. Maybe you've helped so many people you can't even remember who you helped, which is the way it should be. Whether you've given to somebody on the street, whether you've taken somebody into your home, whether you've taken food to people, whatever it may have been, the time will come when people will welcome you because of what you've done for them. I want you to think of some passages in the New Testament, just three of them out of many, that teach this very thing. In the book of James, chapter 3 and verse 17, is the first of several passages that we could use that show this. Actually, it's chapter 2, beginning at verse 15. James chapter 2, starting at 15. If a brother or sister is naked and destitute of daily food, and one of you says to them, depart in peace, be warmed and filled, but you do not give them the things which are needed for the body, what does it profit? Thus also faith by itself, if it does not have works, is dead. But someone will say, you have faith and I have works. Show me your faith without your works, and I will show you my faith by my works. Then 1 John chapter 3 and verse 17. John likewise deals with the same subject, and of course, both writers came from the same inspiration, so we should not be surprised that it's repeated. But whoso has this world's goods and sees his brother in need and shuts up his heart from him, how does the love of God abide in him? My little children, let us not love in word or in tongue, but in deed and in truth. And then finally in Ephesians chapter 4, verse 28. The Apostle Paul says, "Let him that stole steal no more, but rather let him work with his hands the thing that is good, that he may have to give to him that needeth." Now, Jesus doesn't teach us to give our entire paycheck every week or every month to somebody else. When Paul gave his instructions to former thieves, he said, you should have something set aside to be able, when you find someone in need, first of all, the hierarchy is Christians first, the world next. But when you find somebody in need, you don't say, well, depart, be filled and warmed, I hope somebody helps you. Like so many of the people we pass, you know, we come to a stoplight and you hear all these people coming at, knocking on our window or holding up signs or whatever. And I'm not saying that we're necessarily obligated to give all to these people. But on the other hand, one never knows who's in need and who is not. But we do have an obligation when we find, especially Christians in need, and obviously financial need in this case, that we share with them part of what God has given to us. But if we spend the entire paycheck every month, especially on things that we do not need, and there's a difference between need and want. We go to the stores and say, oh, I need that. No, let's be honest. It's, I want that. You don't need it. You've got a closet full, or you have a pantry full, or whatever. So let's be honest with ourselves and don't say, I need that. We need to say, I want that. I don't need it, but I want it. And if we get rid of some of our wants, maybe we would have what Paul said in Ephesians 4:28, something to give to those who do have need. Some of you may have already gotten your tax refund. Others, like us, are still waiting for it. The question is, what will you do with some of it? Will it all go into the bank? Will you pay off credit cards and debts and so on and have nothing left over? Or will you, as Paul instructed former thieves, and really all of us, set some of that aside in some kind of an account so that when you come upon somebody in need, you'll be able to help them? I've been encouraged the last 2 or 3 years on the campus of FC to see young people put up signs about the brethren in what used to be Rhodesia. They are starving. 1 year they raised $5,000 for those brothers and sisters. They live in poverty that you've never seen in Tampa. You've never seen any place in this country poverty in which those brethren live in that part of Africa. The man who rules the country is a multimillionaire, but he starved his people at his own expense. So whether it's your check from the IRS, or whether it's a bonus you got at work, or whether it's some extra money you've come upon, what are you going to do with it? Will we do as Jesus said and give it to those in need so that someday we will be welcomed into that kingdom by many whom we've helped? If there's some way we can help you now, we ask you to come as we stand and sing.